My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing.
Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and I just wanted to give you a brief introduction to the episode that you'll be listening to today. When John approached me about doing Mormon Expression Voices, he told me that one of the things that he would like to see happen is to have families sit down and have conversations about the church and record them. But that can be kind of intimidating to a family, so it hasn't been something that's been featured on Mormon Expression very often. Today we get to listen to such a recording, and I wanted to give you a brief introduction about what you'll hear. In this episode, Gail and his ex-wife Stacy talk to their sons, AJ and Doug, about their journey through Mormonism and the unique challenges that all of them faced with dealing with the doctrines about sexual identity. You'll hear mostly from Stacy and Gail and a little from their son AJ, and their younger son Doug pipes up a couple of times. Just for clarity's sake in the story, I wanted to identify a couple of people. They refer to Katie a couple of times. She is an LDS woman who stepped in and became a mother figure to Stacy in her younger years. And at one point later in the audio, you will hear a person named Amy ask Gail a question about Stacy's sexuality. Another quick note about the audio. Due to that technical complication, I lost the last few minutes of the audio, and it was just a few minutes at the end where they were wrapping up their feelings about the church. As you can tell, I think, from the warmness of the interactions between Gail and his ex-wife and their children, it's safe to say that life after Mormonism has been good to this family. I hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you.
I grew up in a Mormon family, pretty active, Orthodox, I would think. We always went to church, did the family home evening thing. Weren't allowed to drink Pepsi, the whole works. I think I enjoyed the church when I was a kid. I looked forward to going on a mission and attending BYU because all my two brothers went on a mission and my siblings all went to Brigham Young University, almost all. When I was a teenager, my second to the youngest sister went to Hong Kong, which was very cool to watch. And she got home, and it was just really exciting to talk to her about her experience because, I mean, by that time, I was 17 and really looking like this is coming to a close thing. That was a really exciting thing to talk to her about her mission. I was really looking forward to it. I was old for my grade, and I went into my senior year as 19. One year I took a few credits in summer school so I could actually graduate. Well, I could finish my credits in January, and I left on my mission. February, actually, 3rd, when I went into the MTC of my senior year school, and I served in California Ventura Mission.
You never graduated in high school. You never participated in that.
No. The way it happened is the graduation didn't happen until the actual graduation time, but I was on the mission. And I was not really heavily involved in the culture of my high school. So
you were heavily involved in your Mormon culture.
Yeah. Well, every Saturday night I was at the church dances and, you know, the works. My mission was a really kind of it was a good experience, but a very complex experience. I remember, I enjoyed being a missionary, although I had a mission president that was very much into these programs. Like, there's a program called Feed Your Sheep. It looked really ridiculous to me. So we'd take these sheets of paper with sheep she printed on them what the members would put it on their fridge, and every time they did something like talk to their friends about the church or give out a Book of Mormon, they could add cotton balls to their sheet. And the more cotton balls that got on their sheep, they were better member missionaries. And they were always doing endless programs like this, which I participated in, but I always kind of thought they were pretty humorous.
That seems like primary for adults.
And then he also started this program called Beat Your Best, and at the zones got more baptisms in a month than they ever did before. Then the zone had beat their best. I was in this zone, of the zone in Simi Valley, and I was a district leader, and the zone leaders were really intent because Simi Valley was the only zone that...
Can you kind of explain what district and zone is?
Yeah. The district is a group of maybe two or three companionships, and there'll be one missionary in that group that was considered the district leader, and they were always the guys because they were younger and didn't know what they're doing compared to the sisters that might actually have been very good leaders, but didn't hold the priesthood, so of course. But then the zones were typically around 10 companionships or 10 to 10 companionships, I don't know, 10 to 15 companionships, and a number of districts. Well, this zone was the only zone that hadn't beat their best, and our zone leaders were really intent that we were going to beat our best. And I forget how many baptisms we had to get. And they were doing all sorts of things to get more baptisms. And a preparation day, the day off, many of the missionaries had got together and we watched the movie Caveman. I mean, supposedly we were only supposed to watch movies that are off the approved list and with other missionaries on P-Day. But nobody had this approved list. But as part of the movie, the cavemen like made up words for different things. And I remember one of the... This movie relates to the story of Beat Your Best, really. I'll get there. But one of the words they made up for sex was zog-zog. But one night on Thursday night, we typically, after we were done working, we'd play basketball. And after basketball, the zone leaders called this special zone meeting. And we went into the Relief Society room and we're talking. And they had this all figured out that if we all, like, decided on something we could give up extra special and pray to God that we would give this up if we could beat our best, that we would sacrifice. And everybody was really quiet, and they're like, we want everybody to, like, decide on what they're... So I raised my hand and said, like, zog zog? Which didn't go over too well, but I thought it was funny, but... because I thought this was kind of a ridiculous program again, but anyway. That was kind of my mission experience.
Zog zog.
They were kind of embarrassed because the sisters were there who hadn't watched the movie with us. And the sisters were like, what? What? And all the zone leaders would say, well, you should have given that up already. Anyway. So
did you beat your best?
We did, twice. We even got back-to-back, a t-shirt that said back-to-back, because we did it the next month, too. The next month, when we were going to do it the second time, my companion and I actually had a lot of people that we were teaching and that were getting baptized. And I was training a new missionary, which we called Greenies. The zone leaders came over and looked at our teaching pool, and we had all these people we happened to be teaching. And they said, what they told us was, they go, you have this many baptisms scheduled, which were like three, which was a lot for this mission, and for my mission. But they said, these other people in your teaching pool, if you can commit one more and get another baptism, we'll take you to go see the movie Batman, which... You were not supposed to go see movies in a theater, but they were telling us that if we got an extra baptism, and I just said, no. I'm not going to do that. First of all, if they're ready, they'll get baptized. But second of all, I'm not taking my greenie to a movie theater. Anyway, aren't we just kind of defeating the purpose here? Anyway, I finished my mission, had a good time, and then came home. And when I got home, I went to a young adult dance and with my friend Matt, one of my best friends, and he happened to ask Stacy to dance, and I was smitten, and I was just waiting for them to stop talking after they danced, ask her to dance, and they never stopped talking. And I just sat there across the room, gazing at her. She doesn't remember this night, but anyway. So, why don't we back up?
I only remember the next day. That's when I met you.
Yeah. So why don't we back up and hear about your church experience?
I want to hear about the next day.
You get to hear about it. In my story, I was born of a Navy man and a homemaker Australian woman who came here from Australia when she was 19. She married a bunch of sailors, my dad being the fourth one. And the one that lasted the longest, because they were actually married for 5 years. But I didn't remember living with my father, because they were divorced when I was 3. So I lived with a single mom in most of that time period. Before, I was cognizant, was in Tucson, Arizona. And then I remember starting kindergarten in Tucson, Arizona. And the worst part of my experience in Tucson was when the Baptist bus came around and picked up all the little kids. And she would put us in our Sunday clothes and put us on the bus. And there's a little picture of us, me, 5-year-old, my brother, 4 years old. And we're all dressed up. I have the pigtails and he's got the little blue suit. And he's grinning to beat the band. I have this scowl on my face and it, I don't know. But I've seen it in my children since then. When they don't like something a lot, and they're like going, I can't stand this, but I'm doing it anyway kind of thing. And I did that. So I went to Baptist Bible Church, and they gave my brother a Bible. One of those little tiny ones. I was so annoyed. And I never wanted to go back, because I'm like, they give my brother a Bible, and they give me one. I'm smarter. I'm older. I should get the Bible. Okay. So it wasn't long after that that my mother got married to this guy, and we moved to Washington State. We weren't there very long before she shipped us off to our dad for a couple weeks, where I turned 6 and got my first guitar. I was a rock star for my 6th birthday. Anyway, while we were there, my dad, she divorced this man. I came back to, once again, living with a single mom. She had us moving around a lot in Washington State. My most intense memory from when we moved to Washington State was my first day in kindergarten. This huge banana slug. I had never seen a slug in my life up until that point. And I screamed bloody murder, and the custodian came and took care of it. The other thing I remember from that year was the cauldron at Halloween time. The cauldron root beer that was bubbly. That was the coolest thing. But I didn't, the church didn't come into my life until I was about 6 years old. My mother was selling Mary Kay. I just remember those paddles, those little pink paddles, and she'd stir up stuff in these little tiny containers, do these makeup for these women. My brother and I went with her because, we were just little. And some guys came knocking on this door of these people that she was doing this makeup thing, Mary Kay thing with. And they invited this family to hear about, more about Jesus or whatever they were teaching. And my mom was the only one who actually listened beyond that first lesson. And we would go, and these guys, and they'd have these big notebooks full of all these pictures. And, we'd listen for a little while, and then we go and play. And pretty soon, my mom got baptized into the church. It was kind of cool. It was interesting, different. I was kind of bored. But then the my favorite part was getting, crawling under the benches, and she would bring these big pads of paper, and we would just color, and we'd have her draw pictures, and we'd color them and stuff, underneath the benches at church. And I got involved in the choir when I was like 7, so right before I turned 8, the missionaries came and taught me, because my mom was a recent convert. I don't know if they have missionaries teach kids all the time. We called it the one Elder Ketchup, because his name was Ketchum from Idaho, but it was more fun to call him Ketchup. These guys baptized me, and I had some lady talk or whatever. Anyway, my mom made me the dress. My mom sewed me. Well, she had sewn me clothes when I was little, too. Huh? She made me my baptismal dress, and had a little blue stitching around the top. And I found out, you know, that wasn't like the protocol, and we're supposed to have any color on it. We did. It worked out. And I had a hole between my legs. And then we got baptized, you know, because it floated up. So they made me hold it between my dress, between my legs.
Because if the dress goes up, then it doesn't count.
Yeah. So I came up, and it was okay. It was different. But I remember later on, when I was an adult, people would tell me, like, what an incredible event it was. And my oldest child also had a very intense spiritual, emotional experience, and I had an intense emotional experience when he was baptized. But for myself, not so much. It was just, I guess I was more, like, just scared and, like, but, you know, kind of not knowing really what was going on. And I think there was other things in my life that were more scary and more prominent. But after that, I had Sister Perkins. Sister Perkins was my Sunday school teacher. She taught us all about the prophets, and she had us make this book. And it was the most beautiful thing. I love that lady. We would go to her house during the week. I still have that book that I made when I was 9 years old. And it was that same year. So this is when I started to do it. When I was 8 and got baptized, not much. But when I was 9, they had the revelation of blacks receiving the priesthood. And there was this, we were up in Seattle First Ward, and all the adults were like, you know, like getting all excited and crying, like, and I remember my mom crying, and I was just like, wow, you know, this was like really intense and cool. And I guess I don't know if I started to cry, but maybe I did, just because everybody else was crying. But it was just like this intense moment, and that part, I think, is when I really, with Sister Perkins and that happening, I think I got more attached to the church. And so we were kind of go in and out of activity, but I had different experiences with members of the church and the priesthood, and it didn't work out so great. It was very cautious. So I had this attraction to the church, and I had this repulsion to the church, because some of the members would be loving and wonderful and help me think that, oh, this is great, and then some would be not so great, and I'd be like, something's wrong here. And of course, it was interesting, because mostly the something wrong here centered around men in authority, and the something right about the church was the women teachers. So, when I was 10, the next year we moved from Seattle First Ward, my brother had a home teacher back then, and my mom felt supported up there, but she didn't like us being bussed around in Seattle, so we moved. We didn't have the support as much from the church until I was like 13 or so. We even went inactive for a year. Young women leaders came and you know, invited me to come back. So I did. And my mom didn't like it so much at first because she felt betrayed. And every time I got more involved in the church, she'd feel betrayed, but it wasn't so bad because home life was not so great. So that's why I turned to the church. And I got very, very active. Seminary. I love seminary. It's early morning because we were out in Utah, so I got to go to early morning seminary. And all of those teachers were awesome. I loved the Book of Mormon when I first got introduced to it. And I loved memorizing stuff and just being academically inclined. And academically inclined Mormon. I mean, that was a setup for a downfall, too, because if you're academically inclined, what do you call it?
You're in an intellectual, which is one of the enemies of the...
Yeah,
so you're going to overanalyze.
Yeah, so, you know, at that time, at age 14, you're not analyzing too much, but I did. I started doing that, but there was too much chaos for me to really focus in on what was up with the church. So I just, mostly with my relationships in the church. And so when my mom attempted suicide when I was 14, and the church members, you know, rallied around and took us in, I mean, I think there was this crisis moment, and so the church stepped up during that crisis moment. And so I became more attached to it. And then when I was 16, I moved out of my house, and it was the church members again that stepped up. Specifically, I call her my foster mom, Katie, who stepped up and took me out of the home. So I was sheltered. You know, the church was my
security blanket.
Where the ships come in.
Harbor.
My harbor in the storm. Yes. As my life was so stormy, and the church was so, you know, they had all the answers. They had an answer for everything. But, you know, when I was going to seminary and I was seeing this stuff in the Book of Mormon, like God and Jesus are one, and then, you know, and then God is the Father and Jesus is the Son, but then Jesus is the Father and the Son. I was getting confused. I was asking questions, you know, and they couldn't answer some of my questions. So, always makes sense, but I held on to the things that felt good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. And Katie helped me get to BYU because my chaotic home life had not prepared me for anything outside of anything in the future, you know, like work, school, or anything. So she helped me do that. And then, so it's all these women in the church, strong, happy, you know, good examples, good moms, all these women. That's what kept me in the church. And then I went to BYU, and I just poured myself into all this stuff because it was like surrounded by other Mormons. Oh my gosh. It was crazy. I mean, I spent hours and hours reading the Book of Mormon and praying and trying to gain that testimony. I wanted to have that burning in the bosom. And it didn't ever quite happen, but it was close enough, you know. I came home after the end of winter term. I guess there's fall and winter term. And that's, you know, I went to one of those dances. And Katie had talked to me about going on a mission, so I was like, yeah. She talked to me at Christmas time. And that's something I thought I wanted to do, because after I got to BYU, all the young men went on missions, but a lot of the girls did too. I knew that was more my focus in life, would be of a more spiritual nature. I just had this drive to, like, fix the world. So I came home, and I went to this dance because I was going to work and save money. So I, you know, Gail tells the story that he saw me across the crowded room, and that was it for him, you know. He saw this gorgeous woman with long, curly, blonde hair, and that was me. I didn't notice him, of course, because, you know, I just talked to this guy. But he invited me to church where there's singles.
The map guy.
And so I said, okay. And he picked up his friend, which was Gail, AJ's father.
Because I found out he was giving her a ride, so I requested a ride as well.
And that's the first time I met Gail. And I was really pretty impressed because he was a fresh returned missionary. And I was going on my mission, so that was still part of who he was very much. You know, he would talk about things, and he was more spiritually inclined than his friend Matt. And so I was more drawn to him because, like, that's what I wanted, you know, because I was really working hard studying my scriptures a lot and getting ready to go to the temple and all that kind of stuff. So I went to the temple, and that was a pretty cool moment. I went with Katie. This guy that I met when I went to that singles war, Gail, who I follow him, decided that he wanted to date me, so I said, okay, you know, I'm going on a mission, but this will be fun. And he was, like, really trying to date me, but I limited him to once a week. So I was like, I'm going on my mission, and, you know, that's what I'm doing. So that's what I did. That's how we met.
What's the whole story about the goldfish?
Goldfish?
Oh.
I forgot about the goldfish. When I was leaving
college.
Okay, when I was leaving college, I was packing up, and I had these goldfish that I'd had since I was a sophomore. So, and I was this is the end of my junior year of college. And so I'm packing them up, and I'm packing up everything, but I had these fish. So I was taking them to a friend so that they could take care of them, because I was going off on this mission. So
yeah.
Anyway, I didn't want to transport them. So this friend was staying there in Utah, and so carrying them down the stairs from my... I lived on the second floor of this apartment building. I'm carrying them down the stairs, and I trip on the last stair. I go flying, and the fishbowl goes flying, and I try to grab it, and I do. I'm successful at grabbing the fishbowl, but the fishbowl and I both land smack on the concrete, and the fishbowl happens to land right on my finger. And my finger splits open and splurts blood, like 30 feet or so. It was, like, pretty incredible. And but the fishbowl was saved, and the fish were saved. Okay.
And so when I met her, her finger was wrapped up.
Yeah, and so that was, like, kind of a distinctive part of me that, you know, was a conversation piece, because I had this huge bandage on my finger. I had to go to the emergency. They had to take the nail off of my finger and sew up my finger. They couldn't do anything about my shattered bone at the tip of my finger. It was shattered. They couldn't do anything about that. And that's why this finger's flat at the top. But they could sew back up the skin that had split open. And so I had to regrow my finger down and all that. But yeah, it was this nice conversation piece as I walked around with this huge finger sticking out. So that was another thing that helped help me meet guys.
Which was such a thing on her mind.
So that's the story of the finger. Yep. the goldfish. The goldfish, yes.
Well, we were actually on a date the night that your call came. You got a phone call or something. It seems like we saw Katie's daughter, and she said, "You have mail from the church at my house," and we ran over one evening, and I sat in Katie's living room while you read your call.
Yeah. You're so scared.
I was shaken.
Where did you want to go?
I don't know. I was really kind of open. I think that's why I was so nervous, but I didn't have a foreign language, and so it wasn't likely that I would go someplace that spoke a different language, because I didn't take that in school. So I was thinking, okay, I won't have to go to Mexico. and because I heard horror stories about Mexico, about people, especially the getting sick and having stuff. You know, that's what I didn't want. But I ended up going to the Philippines, where you can get really sick and have really scary...
But you did well.
What do you call it? Parasites?
Ugh. Yeah.
Cystosomiasis, where it's blood food that, like, goes and it, like, sits in your brain. Yeah, it's really gross.
But...
It gives you early onset Alzheimer's.
You didn't have any of that, did you? No. You were pretty lucky.
I was very fastidious. Yeah. I didn't wear open-toed shoes like some. I wore closed-toed shoes, and that probably helped a little bit, though. Anyway.
And you cut your hair short, so you didn't get lice.
Yeah, all the sister missionaries got lice, but I didn't, because I had a really short haircut. But that wasn't what happened. When I went on my mission, I had hair halfway down my back. I had really long hair. But if you can imagine the Philippines, and it's 100 degrees average temperature and 100% humidity, I decided very intelligently, unlike some of the other sister missionaries who were more vain than me, that I would chop off that 12 inches of hair or more. I think it was probably more like 20 inches of hair, but something like that, because it was halfway down my back.
Yeah.
Okay, so I chopped it all off, and one of my companions took it and sent it to her aunt, who would make wigs out of it. So it was really quite useful. And anyway, so I had this short haircut, and it was pretty distinctive, because a lot of the other sister missionaries had short haircuts. I heard one other.
That's not how
it was. A normal thing for a sister missionary.
Grandma Katie didn't tell the story of how you lost all that hair that way. She said you cut off all your hair when you had kids.
No.
Okay. Actually, when I had children, when you guys were small, I often grew my hair out and then cut it off. Grew my hair out.
Okay.
Cut it off. My hair out. Cut it off.
Yeah.
I kept doing that.
So, tell us about your mission. Did it reinforce the experience you had had previously in the church? The dichotomy.
The dichotomy kept growing. Yes, this is the pivotal time of my life. Because it definitely contributed to that dichotomy. It was really hard to have men or boys who were younger than me telling me what to do, and I had to get approval from them. That was really difficult. Like, I had to have them baptize my converts, or just little things that just started to really gnaw at me. But in my mission, they had this thing called a sister. It was sort of like she was the self-reliance, the leader of the self-reliance sisters, because we went there not only to preach the gospel, but to help people learn how to, like, sanitize food sanitize, you know, and take care of themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just basic first aid and basic sanitation. So there's one sister that got to be, like, a sister's own leader. So she got to be the person in the office and leading all the other sisters, which was kind of cool. So that's something that, at least in our mission, you can have something like that. The sisters get to do something in the leadership part.
That's pretty cool, because I haven't heard of that in other missions.
Yeah. And I don't know how long it lasted. It's still going on, I doubt it, because it became controversial when I was there. Anyway, so I'm not sure where I'm going with this. What was your question again?
Oh, I was just asking if that dichotomy was reinforced on your mission.
Yeah, I had kind of a crazy... my trainer was okay, but then she was gone after 1 month. He changed my companion, which is not the norm. They usually have you a couple, 2-3 months together, and then switch you. But when I was young in the mission, they kept changing my companions. First two I only had for 1 month each. They just kept switching around. Well, Sister Penny was the second companion, and she was just a little intense. My first one, I wanted to do more work. I was so gung-ho. I was going to go out there, and I was going to be baptized, but I was kind of scared because I didn't know the language. I thought this was an English-speaking mission. They spoke this language called Warai Warai, which means nothing, nothing. My first companion tried to help me learn that dialect, and that was good. And I would focus so hard. I would fall asleep while we were teaching discussions because I was focusing so hard. And I would come home at the end of the day, and it would be like before 8 o'clock because the sisters had to be home by 8 at the latest. And I'd come home, and I was so tired, I would just collapse, and I would sleep in my clothes, and I thought that was the most horrible thing. Because we would have our prayers, the companionship prayer, and we'd have our individual prayers, and I'd be sleeping, kneeling beside my bed for a couple hours, and then I'd get up and get it, crawl into bed, because I'm so tired, and they just thought I was the just grossest thing, but anything, anyway. So finally, by the time Sister Pena came along, I got my missionary leg, I guess is what you would say, and she was a really intense worker, so we were going, and it was kind of cool, but she wasn't helping me with the language, so it was even harder. I had huge headaches because I was just trying so hard to learn the language and to really understand what people were saying. And I got sick, and I didn't want to go with her. And they started reporting me because the missionary training center had stocked me up with this bunches of vitamins because they wanted to keep their American missionaries healthy, sending them to this foreign country, right? So they stocked me up with a whole bunch of vitamins. And I was taking these vitamins, and they reported to my mission president that I was taking drugs.
You were abuser on your mission.
Yeah, and I got upset at me, and I also got upset one time because I was really sick, and something happened, and I just got really upset, and I stayed home because I was so sick. That was part of the report, was that behavior, and then the fact that I was taking drugs. So we had monthly interviews with mission president. And they interviewed my companion first. I'm just kind of there, you know, and then they interview me and he starts talking to me about all these accusations. He actually interviewed a couple other people and then have you come in, and he's told me all the accusations against me. And I was just, like, so amazed. I did tell him that it was just vitamins. He thought I was from this situation. This, I guess this seed of doubt was planted in his mind or something about me. And so from then on, it was difficult, anything with this guy, because he thought I was a problem for the Filipina sisters. I stayed in that area for a long time, and my next companion became the sister zone leader at one point, but came out of my companionship. So I have all these people who've been in there for a while. Neither of us spoke the language very well, although she was a little bit more fluent. And so one of our house help, we call him Nanites, and Nanai Kalas went out teaching with us because she could speak English and she could speak Hawaii. So she would translate for us when we would go and teach. These two American sisters would go out and teach these lessons. And we were attractive because we were two white girls out there. So people actually listened to us a little bit more. They opened their doors a little more. And we were teaching people, and we didn't, you know, my instincts, I didn't follow my instincts well. This family wanted to be baptized, and we had another white elder interview them, and I knew that they weren't quite ready, but I didn't say anything, and he approved them, and it was not very long after, because it turned out that the wife had a drinking problem, and so she wasn't ready to give up the drinking, and she went back to drinking very quickly after. And then after Sister Ott was Sister Bakdabu, who was my favorite companion. And her and I, we worked really good together. Then I moved to a different area and got this really crazy lady. And she would teach all these false doctrines. And things started to fall apart. So I guess the most difficult time was when I went and talked to the mission president of one of those monthly interviews. And I shared with him about my home life, what it had been like. And it was like a couple of days later, I heard one of the people I was teaching, one of the children of the people I was teaching, said something to me about saying how sorry they were about my childhood. When I heard that, I was so hurt, and I tried to go to the mission president, and he says, "So?" I lost all respect for that man at that point, because he thought, like, you know, you're confident, you know, you go to them in confidentiality, it's supposed to be. It's like it's a priest or whatever. There's this confidentiality piece, and he didn't respect that in my case, and I don't know if he respected it in other people's cases, but he certainly didn't respect it in mine. And I lost most all my respect for the priesthood. If it hadn't been for Elder Reyes, I doubt that I would have had any ability to come home and entertain the thought of marrying one of those priesthood holders. Because before I left my mission, about two-thirds of the way through, I had a companion who was a very affectionate person and who stirred up some feelings that I never had really experienced before. And that was when I first suspected that I was not exactly heterosexual material. So I come home, and during this whole time when I was on my mission, this boy named Gail Bartholomew had been writing to me, and he also sent me Twinkies, and because I was spiritual, I said, the man who sends me Twinkies is the man I'm going to marry. And then when I come home, he's there, and I have to face the facts that something's going to happen, and he asked me to marry him. So I have these issues on the mission. Priesthood is bad, very, very bad, and there's this question about what's going on with my sexuality. And then there's all of the pressure to come home, get married, have kids, and be a perfect Mormon woman. And that's where the story turns.
Turns to, we get married. Well,
and then there was all the bad omens.
No, I mean, your father was, you know, probably the best guy that I had ever met. I mean, the thing was, the reason I considered him as a potential mate is because before my mission, he didn't lay a hand on me. Not once. And every single other guy I had dated had tried to make the moves, you know? And your father was the only respectful man.
I had this...
That's the only guy that was ever going to have a chance with me.
When I went on my mission, I knew I didn't want a girlfriend. I didn't want to have this waiting thing. And I knew she wanted to go on a mission, so I'm like, I'm just going to be here. And I was going to be around her as much as she let me. But I don't think she even thought she'd see me again, because the last time we dated before we left, I prepared a candlelight dinner, and we went to the beach, and I said, I've really had a fun time getting to know you, and I think you're a really special girl, and I'd like to see you when we get back. And
When you come home,
and she says, well, you're going to be at BYU. And she told me later that she's like, she thought we'd never meet up again at BYU, because, I mean, there's 35,000 undergraduate students there. But I was at the airport when she got home.
Whoa.
In fact, if he hadn't have made all those checking on when I was actually going to be coming home, nobody would have been there to meet me.
Nobody would have known.
They didn't send the letter until later. It came, the letter saying, your missionary's coming home on such and such a date. They got there after I got there.
So there was two times on our mission. Once, there was a huge earthquake and flood in the area that she had just left. But we didn't know she had left.
Yeah.
And I spent all night long one night calling the mission home until I got through and found out she was safe. And I told the people back in Frederick, Washington, that, like Katie and them, that were waiting to know that she was safe. And then when she was, I was in the middle of my semester when she was coming home at school. Spent a long time getting through to someone on the mission home that would tell me anything because, you know, I'm nobody. And I found out, it was between tests. And so I took my whole paycheck and bought a round-trip plane ticket and went up to see her get off the plane. And somebody in her mission office, when she came through and said, there's a boy waiting for you.
Sister Snyder, there's someone waiting to meet you.
That is also a stalker.
It was. I was a total stalker.
He was, but it was successful. Because if he hadn't been persistent, I would have given it a second thought. He had persistence. In fact, he had great persistence.
Oh, wow.
Well, we got married, and we...
Five and a half months after our return from mission.
Wow. That's so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think it's fast. Your mom, really.
I didn't even know this guy.
When we got... the first 2 years of our marriage, we were at BYU, and no kids, but we lived in this little tiny apartment.
And we went back to BYU.
Yeah.
So that was the hardest part for me after my mission, was coming back to BYU. Because before I had done all this preparation, it was a place to prepare me to go on this mission. But when I came back, things were all different. I didn't have as, innocent a perspective. The church, and I could not stand BYU any longer. And I was very much reading the alternative papers that were being printed, delving into, you know, more scholarly pieces of the church, although I still held to the church authors in the church versus outside the church.
Like, you read a lot of...
Hugh Hibley.
What's the Journal of Mormon Experience?
Dialogue.
You read a lot of dialogue and things like that.
What was that newspaper that was used?
Student Review.
Student Review.
I read a lot on my mission, and before I knew, you know, the standard line, and on my mission I noticed that even, like, Talmadge and McConkie disagreed about stuff, so I'm like, I couldn't take everything literally, and at BYU I learned about, like, evolution, and I started thinking about things and reading the dialogue and things. I really started thinking about all of that, but we were very devout in a lot of ways, but kind of disgruntled.
I switched my loyalty from the church community and the church as a culture into the church doctrine. And so that's what I tried to do, is I tried to shift my focus there and really delve deeply into it so that I could have that be my connection and that my stability with the church. Because all of that interactions with members of the church, especially people who, quote, held the priesthood, made me very much leery of the church culture. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't say it was okay the way women were treated. I couldn't say it was okay that God's authority was held and directed by male persons.
Well,
and that's why when I married Gil, I told him, I said, you're going to have to make up for all those horrible men that I've had the experience of my whole rest of my life. And that's why I chose you, and that's your, and I apologize beforehand.
And
gonna
more than once.
That's going to be your task, is to sort of rewrite my relationship with men.
Which,
in the church.
I'm not sure if I ever really did that well, but kind of.
Better than anybody else.
When, I mean, not really keeping chronologically, but we were talking about how you kind of had a issue with, like, the culture of the church and were submersing yourself in the doctrine. I think both of us kind of talked about that issue with culture. Like, when we lived in Pleasant Grove in the apartments, all the people we hung out with and wanted AJ to play with were the people that either didn't go to church, were non-members, or that one couple that were self-proclaimed apostates. We had less issue with any of those people than the people that went to church every week. We thought they were all weird.
What about Emily's parents?
They were not, they never went to church. They would sit out on the porch next to us and smoke. But we really liked them a lot. We thought they were great people for you to play with.
Because the only person I remember was Emily from the apartments.
Yeah. But there was other kids, but we just thought their families were scary. But
so, AJ, when I married your dad, we did talk. I talked to him about what had happened on my mission.
Yeah.
And concerning my sexuality.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was this teaching, you know, and I before I left on my mission at BYU, there was this talk that said any man, any boy, and any girl who walked out of this talk, you know, who are living the gospel, can come together in a marriage that is fitting to God. So, I mean, I could look at talk,
But that was a huge teaching.
It was a thing to me, that saying, like, if I was obedient enough to the gospel, right, this would work.
If both of us were obedient, we could
make
it work.
I knew that your dad was, like, head over heels. Like, he was, you know, I was the knee, bee's knees. Right? I was the apple of his eye. I was the bee's knees. I was the cream in his cocoa. You know, whatever. And so I thought that over time that I could shift, see, and that would...
And I'd become the bee's knees, too.
That would make a difference for me, because I respected, you know, I respected him, his everything, and he came from Mormon stock, and he was a hard worker, and he was respectful.
Yeah.
See, there's all those things that made it...
And we were friends. I mean, we talked a lot.
Well, your father talked a lot.
So you knew a lot about him, but he knew nothing about you.
I remember a lot of things that you shared and your thoughts. And anyway.
Yes, but we did. We influenced each other. When we could get into discussions, it was after the first little while. He was very much a talker, and I was very much a listener, but it became a little more even over time. And when we would get into intellectual discussions, we could have a really good time. And so that was the hardest part, is the intimacy part. I needed to feel connected, and I needed the intellectual piece. And of course, you know, that everybody needs that. And you came into the picture, AJ.
Yeah.
You were very much wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was planned.
Yes, you were. I wanted you, and, well...
She actually calculated when she had graduated the first year we were married,
uh-huh.
and she calculated when I would graduate and when she could have the baby after I graduated, and you came, what, 2-3 weeks after I graduated?
3 weeks after I graduated.
We planned it, like...
Well, I didn't want to have a kid before.
Yeah.
We were into, after we got our bachelor's degree, yeah.
Yeah. Before you had a job, so, you know.
I started my job, and a week later, you were here.
Boom.
Yeah. A sunny Sunday. Blithe and bonny.
Good and gay.
Good and gay. From the get-go. Yes, that is another story. And I remember, AJ, when you were little, and you still apologize for this every once in a while, that when you wanted a Barbie for Christmas, and it was like, it was just like this tiny, you know, it was so hard. That's why I chose certain names for my children, so that they would be very masculine and very feminine.
Well, when we were engaged, you said that's the rule, because she was getting sick of getting mail with my name on it for the women's organizations that she wanted to get mail for. And she's like, Gail, this is the rule. When we have babies, they have to be very masculine or feminine names. None of this
gender-neutral
crap.
And so,
I guess crap was added afterwards. Yeah, that's not the word she ever used. That's always been my word.
Gender-neutral. And, you know, I think it was my reaction to myself, uh-huh. pushing that down and pushing myself into the church.
But then you ended up picking names that didn't end up being that way.
Well,
like, I mean, like when they're shortened, like AJ or Alex.
Alex is gender.
Yeah,
sure.
But Alexander and Anthony both are very, very masculine.
But that's not
like
what you
Abraham.
Ended up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not what you ended up calling us.
That's true.
Yeah.
We called you H.A., and that could be either, and we called you Alex, so that could be either.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how it turned out was, like, not...
It was okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I wanted you to have nicknames.
Yeah. That was important to both of us. We wanted you to have really strong names, and all four of you have really strong names, and to have cool nicknames.
Yeah. I want to have cool nicknames.
So you don't have to walk around as Alexander Douglas Bartholomew or Anthony Joseph Bartholomew. You can have something.
So I was wanted a Barbie. That was hard for me because I was like really pushing the
trucks,
the stuff.
Well, like you said, when you were all excited to have a boy, when you got a boy, because you're like, oh, I can play trucks with him, because that's what...
And you wanted to play Barbie. I hated Barbie. So I sent you next door to play with Emily.
And Emily had this, like, huge treasure trove of Barbies and a big Barbie house. And
I know, and you guys would play for hours.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't his fifth birthday that we got him
for
Barbie
movies.
And...
No,
bad hitter Ken.
He was four.
Yeah.
Oh, it was four. Okay.
And
at three, I gave him two of them, but then...
No, we got them all at once, because I remember that vividly.
And I like the little people, the little ones.
Oh, you got me little people, little dolls. But then I remember when we got Barbies, we went into the store and I picked them out and I got African-American woman with her little African-American girl and then Bad Hair Ken and Bad Hair Ken Jr. And we were in the checkout and the cashier lady asked if I was buying this for a friend of mine or something. And I said, no, it was for me, with a big smile on my face.
He says these stories, but I don't remember.
I remember
exactly
this.
The way he does, but it's okay. I don't remember it at all. I've blocked it out.
Oh, I remember this because I was like, I'm finally getting a Barbie.
I know.
Was it difficult?
It was difficult.
And then...
Because I didn't like Barbies anyway. But,
well, you know. And I had different issues with Barbies.
You guys felt like they were anti... Like,
anti-feminist. I mean, I felt I had problems with the body issues of Barbie.
Yeah.
And the whole Barbie thing was just, ugh. And then my son wanted Barbies. And then my dad came. Oh, gosh.
And thought you
and
were...
And he saw this, and he was just, like, mortified. And he was just like, you know, he gave us these looks. And I was just like, oh, I hid AJ from my dad for so many years.
Yeah.
I talked to AJ about how my dad was.
And how he needed to act
around my dad.
Yeah, I also, got that same mentality from...
My dad.
Your dad. Like, I remember the conversation when I was, I don't know how old I was, but he sat me down and told me why boys don't wear girls' clothes.
Because he would always do dress-ups. Because
I would dress up, and the fun dress-ups are all the feminine ones.
And
grandma's like, don't bother him, he'll grow out of it.
I didn't know that my dad had that conversation with you.
Yeah.
I thought he was less vocal than
he pulled me aside in a room.
He was just more private about it.
Yeah.
My dad would tell me, not AJ.
Yeah.
Her dad told me. AJ.
Yeah, he took me into a room and sat me down. So scared. I thought I'd done something wrong. Well, to him, I was.
Yeah.
But you had.
Yeah.
And see, your grandfather, your dad's dad, was the one guy in his family, the person in your dad's family that I felt, you know, the most. I guess most friendly towards or affectionate towards.
Yeah.
And that was the hardest thing later on.
Yeah.
Like, we're kind of estranged now.
It wasn't like if I wanted to cook or stuff, that wasn't an issue, but it was the clothes, I felt like, was the issue.
Because my dad, in some way, I mean, he does quilting now. I mean, those types of things, like cooking or sewing or those things, there was no jobs that were women's jobs in
the
house.
That's kind of cool.
But he grew up on a farm. He does have this unspoken kind of macho thing, but there's a very egalitarian relationship my parents have that for a couple married in the 50s is just amazing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he didn't change diapers, but he did everything else in that household.
And if he needed, I'm sure he changed some diapers, but it was not something he normally did. But if he needed to, and Mom wasn't there, I'm sure he did, but it wasn't his go-to.
So your dad was actually kind of a good person to marry when it came to
feminist
whole relationship about, you know, being equal partners.
Yeah.
And it was hard, not because of the other issues that finally came up later.
I remember you one time early in our marriage, you talked about, and it's always impressed me, you talked about responsibility for and responsibility to. And you're like, for our children, we are responsible for, but to each other, we're responsible to. And there's a huge difference in that really set my mind on a lot of what it means to be partners versus the patriarchal system, which was my first and biggest issue with the church, was the patriarchy.
Even though your dad didn't like patriarchy, he grew up in it, where the dad kind of made the decisions. Or it appeared that the dad was making the decisions, at least in terms of the interaction with the family, because the mom and dad would have discussions behind closed doors, and the dad would come out, and he would make the proclamation to the family.
The other thing that was...
He thought that that's how it would work with us, and I was not buying that.
And the other thing was kind of feeling out what all this meant, because as long as we're active in the church, we're trying to have this equal relationship, but like when we tried to do family home evening and those types of things, I was supposed to be conducting, and trying to do that and be egalitarian was really confusing for me. Trying to be the presider without being the presider Does that make sense to...
Yeah, it was a lot harder for your dad.
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up like that with a lot of family meeting and stuff. And so I thought of it more as a division of labor kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so for me, it wasn't as much an issue in that way because him was all wrapped up in roles.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like, okay, this is the tasks and this is how we share things.
Yeah.
And so that's why it took so long for us to really get to that point where we could be working together well, because he had to unwrap the whatever he was doing from the roles. He had to take them apart. This is a role. These are things that we do. And if I put all those things in that role, then I get confused.
Yeah.
In my relationship.
Yeah, it was confusing for me to try to have an equal relationship, but yet I was supposed to be the one, like, conducting and doing those types of things.
Well, when I was young, growing up, I felt like Mom was very much in charge of the household. Like, in the household, Mom ran everything.
Yes.
Everything that happened, Mom knew she was making it happen. And so, when at church they're talking about how the dad does that, I was so confused. I was like, what?
Well, and I was working a ton, so, I mean, and she was home, so...
She had
the structure at home, and I would come home and follow it. I mean, I would want to support that structure.
The whole time we were married, he was often working two jobs.
Yeah. Like, Dad was hardly around when it was really little.
Yeah. And now, the situation is kind of reversed.
Well, it's more equal.
Yeah.
Which is great. And we talked about that from the beginning. We wanted a more equal parenting thing.
It took me going to work to make that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it started when I went back to school.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, because then I had to leave the house. I had to leave, and you guys all had to, like, figure out how to manage without me.
Yeah, because whenever Mom left, everything fell apart.
For a long time, for months and months, and I would be like...
Whenever you came back, it was, like,
and I would cry. Scary. I cried for the first 4 months I was in school because my whole life was falling apart.
Yeah.
Like, the house, the whole, like, structure.
But everybody was so much happier. At the same time. So it was, like, a real struggle for me.
I remember being determined that when you got back from your classes, the kids would be asleep. The house would be at least swept and the dishes would be done. You weren't going to walk in and have to deal with any of that stuff. The first few times, I'm like, how does this ever get done with? I am not going to fail here and have her come home and to see that I cannot handle this, even though I can't.
Well, that's kind of skipping ahead, though.
Oh, that is.
But so, that's okay.
Yeah.
But. So, what happened between the time AJ came along and me going back to school? The whole shifting and shifting happened.
Yeah. We came to Corvallis.
We lived in Pleasant Grove, Utah for a long time.
Yeah.
AJ was 10. Or turned 10 when we moved to Oregon. Mm-hmm. So, up until that time, we had two more kids while we were in Utah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Alex and Abe.
Anyway, AJ was an only child until he was 5. And then he had his brother come along.
And he stole everything.
And he stole all the attention from AJ.
Well, I was a diva from the get-go because my first word was AJ. I mean, it was bound to happen.
Yes, it was. It wasn't Mom or Dad. It was AJ.
It was. His first word. So, when we were in Washington, it was a little bit, we were a little bit free to kind of be who we were.
Yeah.
We had lots of, it was very difficult in our marriage, tension in that spot. But also, we can just kind of be ourselves a little bit, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But when we moved back to Utah, we had to go back into the Mormon culture. Not only was it at church that we had the Mormon culture and church activities, but it was
everywhere.
Everything. Yeah. You know, we lived and breathed the Mormon culture because it was all around us. It started to, like, make me crazy.
That's why I think when we moved to Gold Beach, for me it was a culture shock because, like, totally different.
You didn't know anything else.
I was like, what?
It's interesting to me, though, because it was driving me, the Mormon culture drove me crazy, too, in Utah. It took me a long time to get any appreciation for Utah, but you carved out, like, a society for yourself. I mean, you did a lot of volunteer work and stuff that created a group of friends around you that to deal with.
Yeah, I tried to create a network of people that would kind of balance things for me in that culture, like, that weren't just focused on the church, and even though they were all church members, but I could do something that wasn't focused on the church, and so I focused on the library, created that friends group. And so many things happened in Utah. So many things. Yeah. So many changes happened.
I think Gold Beach was also key because the time, as far as the church goes, the time you spent as gospel doctrine teacher there, all the studying you did, we had lots of conversations about the church, and that seemed really pivotal.
Okay, you know how Mormons moved from back east out to Salt Lake, and they were kind of isolated?
Yeah.
So the culture became stronger as a result of that isolation? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happened to us when we moved to Gold Beach, is that we were really isolated out there, and so we built more of our family, you know, the parents and three little boys became this really tight-knit group, and so we just had to kind of bond together more.
This is dinky, dinky town, and the Mormon church was...
It was a tiny, tiny branch,
and
we both had a couple jobs.
And so church was a huge part of our life, but yet we didn't have to breathe it like we did in Utah.
Yeah, we didn't have to breathe it with everybody else. And that gave us some breathing room. And I did a lot of studying because this was the first time I'd ever taught adults. And so I think that was really kind of pivotal for me. And it was also before I'd left Utah, I'd been struggling with my orientation. And had some revelations in the temple, or yes, this is who you are, kind of thing, but I wasn't ready to accept it at that time. And so I was going to Gold Beach and going, okay, I'm freaking out, I leave the Utah culture, but, you know, at least out here, you know, it's a fresh start. I can kind of try and get rid of all that, or something.
And I find it interesting in looking back, because all of the struggles you had with your sexuality and these revelations, you shared everything with me, but I would have never, the idea that you were gay, still never, those two things never would have connected in my mind. It was like, duh. You know, that just was never a reality or even a question to me, which is weird to me.
I think it's that way we were thinking in the Mormon culture. That wasn't allowed. It was not allowed because it was, like, not there.
It was like it wasn't there, even though I've had friends that were gay for a long time, and I knew it was something real, but somehow it didn't exist in my little world.
In the Mormon culture in Utah.
Doesn't
perceive that she was just facing temptation or something?
Well, that, and I kind of thought that, you know, I didn't know anything about Kinsey, but I kind of thought that everybody has this range of who they're attracted to, and she had some attraction to women, which I'm like, you know, that's not, there's nothing wrong with that, we just have different attractions. So the idea of Kinsey was there, but I had no idea who Kinsey was, or that there's a scale, or anything like that, but that's kind of what I thought.
So we go to Gold Beach, and we're needing to go to... We can't stay there, because you lose your job. We have to figure out what to do. But we're very spiritual. I mean, we spent this whole year really developing our own spirituality to a greater extent. because we did our own studying. You were going to counseling for that whole year.
Yeah.
So you were learning who you were.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it, and it was really huge.
Yeah.
So we had the spiritual opportunity to make a decision where we were going to go after that.
And there was nothing else in Gold Beach. Obviously, we really couldn't stay there.
So I think that was one of the best parts of our marriage, is that spiritual coming together to make a decision. So we did an egalitarian thing.
Yeah.
We both prayed. We both got our answer.
The same one.
And it was Corvallis.
I remember how hard Gold Beach was.
Yeah.
It's not a happy place.
And we really, I think in our hearts, we were wanting a place that would be good for AJ. And we saw...
And for all the kids, but particularly AJ, because he's getting older first.
Yeah. And all they had there was the football team, and
And the basketball team.
And
that's
soccer.
It.
And soccer. I did soccer and basketball.
Yeah.
Well, as a kid, but in high school, all there was football and basketball.
Oh, really? Ew.
That was it.
So, it was very sports-oriented and fishing-oriented, and a lot of the kids would end up, you know, just staying there. And
there was a lot of drugs.
There's drugs. It was a huge meth channel through the Oregon coast.
And massive amount of pot use, medical, but otherwise, because of there was so much medical marijuana. I've never met so many people.
Yeah. So we thought, we need to move to another place in Oregon that would be healthier for AJ, specifically. And for the whole family in general, because, you know, we had to have work. And I wanted better schools for my kids.
And we wanted to be closer to a grad school for mom.
That too. So, we both pray, and then we come to Corvallis.
And when we came to Corvallis, we fell in love with it.
Nobody had jobs. It's just...
No job. No place to live. Found a place to live. It was nasty, terrible. But guess what?
Gosh.
The church. Members of the church came and helped us clean.
Yeah.
That house.
Yeah. That house was...
The church actually helped me find places to clean carpet while I was looking for a job. And
So the church was right there for us during this time. So, you know, it's really hard to leave because the church is always there for you. So we're coming to that point. Because a year after we moved here, I came out to myself and to your dad.
And it was a huge revelation, a very positive.
Yeah. It was a huge amount of work. Yes, BB was a result of that.
BB is the positive result.
And Beatrice means bringer of happiness.
She was our wonderful surprise.
So that began the process of both of us, myself finally coming out, began the process of both of us having to try and reconcile who we really were. You had other pieces, but who we really were. And who we are in relationship to the church. I mean, right at that point in time, we were like, okay, we can make this work. Okay. You know, once you have the understanding of yourself, you've come to terms to accept yourself, great. Now, we can still make this work.
In fact, we thought this will give us an advantage to make it work.
Yeah. You know, always trying to justify the church in our mind.
I think, for me, the first clink... I think that's obviously the start, but one day we were talking, and you had come to terms that you just did not think that homosexuality... I had always thought that homosexuality in itself was not something that God condemned, but the behavior, because somehow in my mind, the Bible must teach against it, so... And I knew there was something dichotomous there, and I didn't really understand it, but you had come to terms with you felt like... homosexual behavior was, there was nothing wrong with it. And before I had...
How did I say that?
I don't remember, but it struck me, and I'm like, okay, I wonder how that is and how that could be. And then I realized, you know, I keep on saying that the Bible teaches against it, but I really don't know where and what it says. And soon after that, I found on the Affirmation site a article about his thesis was that
Affirmation?
Well, Stacy had Googled gay Mormons and found Affirmation, this society, which was a great thing. And she told me about it, and I went to it and found an email group for called Family Fellowship, which I got all these friends on. And she found an email group, Mormon Lesbians. But on the Affirmation site, shortly after you shared that with me, there was an article with the thesis of how gay relationships could work in Mormon theology. But what struck me about the article is he quoted a book called Living in Sin. And I went and got that book, and it was written by an Anglican bishop that taught me a ton about the Bible and the difference between looking at Scripture literally and understanding it in a way that that included the historical background and how it was written and stuff. But he went through and talked about how really there is not a good case to be made biblically for the condemnation of homosexual behavior. And it was like a huge revelation that, you know, like Jesus never condemned it. It's not condemned by in the Ten Commandments. There's just like a condemnation in the book of Leviticus, and Paul condemned it. And yet, there are plenty of other things that Paul teaches that most modern churches don't agree with. And the whole book of Leviticus, I went back and read it and found...
It's all about how it... Part of it is all about identifying spots for leprosy.
Yeah, there's all these things that nobody accepts. So there's really not a good case to be made biblically. But that was like the first run for me, realizing that there's this ersatz proof that the Bible is against homosexuality. It's just not there at all.
I feel like we skipped the part where Antwerp came out, because I feel like that was part of
it. Oh, that was a huge...
That was huge.
Was a huge part in Utah before,
yeah.
Before all of this happened. Thank you, AJ, for reminding us.
Because I feel like that helped us get to that point.
Well, Gail's sister, who was just older than him, came out as a lesbian, and...
I don't think she officially came out, but she was now having a relationship with a woman, and the whole family was freaking out. And
she never used the word gay or lesbian.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, all my siblings were up in arms, and I spent most of my time, sadly, just arguing with them, thinking that they were being jerks about the whole thing. I really didn't deal with my family relationship well there. Because it made me really angry that they were so condemnatory and that they didn't accept that this was a real thing. And that if her being gay, she really should not be staying married, that she needed to move on. But none of my family saw any of that. Most of them still don't believe that she's really gay, even though she's been living with for 12 years. A long time.
For me, I was observing it from getting the perspective from and from point of view. It was so scary during that time because his parents were fighting, and the whole their process to separate was really like difficult, and a lot of stuff happened. And so my first thought when Mom came out, I was like, "Oh no, what's gonna happen?"
Right.
Yeah.
I want to back up when came out. And we went up there, we were visiting with them, and I saw how happy she was.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
I was really upset. I was really angry. But I was also, I totally acknowledged it. I was upset because I was jealous. But I couldn't admit that to myself openly. But I did say to your sister that I'd never seen her happier.
Yeah.
And I had never seen her actually happy. I didn't realize that I hadn't until that time.
Yeah.
And when I said that, she just was so angry at me. And so I buried myself in that book that the young gay man had written in response to the other young man who had taken his own life and trying to be gay and Mormon and stay Mormon and how you can eventually convert yourself. And it was a totally heart-wrenching book. I stayed up all night and read it and just cried and cried and cried. When I came out 2 years later, it took me a while before. I think I was already out for a year to myself before I told AJ.
Yeah.
It was the next summer. But I'd been I've been feeling like for 6 months I needed to talk to him.
And you were what, 14?
No. I was 13.
13.
And so finally I came out to him, and that's when he freaked out. He was like, what's going to happen to us?
I remember shortly after you came out, we were driving to a Mormon camp out. And he goes, I just don't understand, because this isn't what the church teaches. And we talked the whole way to Camp Alpine, and I don't remember exactly what I said, but I was like, I said, I think what I remember is, I go, I think it's what people are interpreting what God wants, because I don't believe at all that God wants. And I tried to say that it's really not backed up scripturally, which probably didn't help a 13-year-old.
It didn't make any sense. But then I remember soon after that, that's when you guys changed the bedroom configuration, and so like, everything was changing, but it wasn't like dramatic change enough. That like, it was little things.
Actually, that wasn't until like Thanksgiving.
Oh, really?
We talked about to you in the summer, and then... It was so nice to have that bedroom change. It's like, oh, this is nice.
That was a huge change for you and I. I don't know about you guys. What was it like for you, Doug?
I didn't know what was happening. I was always confused. I didn't get what you were talking about. Every time you were talking and I was overhearing.
Yeah.
I was always confused. And like,
what did you think when Mom and Dad's change the bedrooms, and
that's when I started to get things.
Yeah.
You were eight.
And I remember one night at the dinner table, you asked, AJ had asked, so when is the divorce happening? Because we were still going through the paperwork and trying to figure out how it worked, and you asked, what does divorce mean? And we're all on pins and needles, and Mom kind of gives it, explains, and I don't remember what you said exactly, but Doug, you just kept on eating, and Stacy goes, what do you think of that? And Doug, you said, oh, that's okay. And just kept on eating, and we're like, what the crud is going on here? But all in that time, too, at some point, this is Proposition 8 made this a much bigger emotional thing, at least for me, and I'm sure for you.
Horrible.
But at some point, as a result of Prop 8, I think you stopped going to church that summer.
No, when I stopped going to church when I started graduate school, because it was kind of an excuse.
Oh, yeah.
But it had been 6 months prior to that that I had really felt that I couldn't continue. So I came out, and then 6 months later, I was really struggling. And so I stopped. No, it was a year and a half later, actually. We kept trying for a year to be involved. And then I came out to AJ, and then I started graduate school.
Oh, cool.
And I tried to hang on for a little bit, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I used that time in graduate school to make the break from the church, and it was after I had my first interaction with a woman that it stopped for me. I stopped paying tithing, I stopped reading the Book of Mormon, I was still going to church, but I was barely getting there, because it was, you know, the whole family was there, and so it just kind of broke for me. And I stopped wearing my garment. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do any of it anymore, because it was Prop 8. It was, and they preached it over the pulpit here in Corvallis. And then the incident with the first woman that I was with, and how her husband tried to choke her, and all these things just came about. And I just said, I can't do it anymore. I can't.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't. I can't try and make it work.
Yeah.
And because I didn't believe it anymore, but I was still trying to make it work for some reason. Because I think it was because I couldn't stand to disappoint everybody all the time.
Yeah.
And it was a huge shift, and I spent so many years of my life working so hard to be in it. And, you know, people would look to me. There's a lot of people who look to me because I would be able to bring a spiritual understanding to situations. And so I let go and I stopped going. And I remember the first Sunday that I didn't go to church.
But we all went.
Because I had gone to church every Sunday for my entire adult life. Mm-hmm. And everybody else went and I didn't go. And I felt like I was falling off the edge of the world.
Yeah.
That day. Because I knew that nothing would be the same. And it was scary. So, I don't know where to go from there.
It seems like the next step is when you started attending Unitarian Church, because... But, can I share...
We want to go to him.
Yeah, let's go to you. So where are you in this process?
Well...
A month after I came out to you, AJ, what happened?
I came out to you. Well, because I was really confused, because I was like... Two women in my life that I... felt really close to, my mom and my aunt had both come out and they're gay, and I'm like, okay, this is really, like, because I'd always been taught that's not how it works. But I'd always struggled with how I felt like I was in the wrong gender role for a long time, because I felt like I did not like trucks, I did not like guns, I didn't like all of that was, like, supposed to be male, but I liked camping and being out in nature with Boy Scouts, but like, there were some things I liked, but most of it I was like, this is not me. So it was really difficult. And then, so I was, like, starting to, like, question myself, because I was like, so is that what I'm feeling not a bad thing? Because, like, I've been because I was trying to be more macho, I felt like, for a little bit. Like, maybe probably didn't work.
I didn't notice you trying to be more macho. Sorry.
Well, I always enjoyed the dichotomy when you were going to scouts and the one scout leader was such a jerk and wanting to saying that your enjoyment in fantasy fiction, we should discourage it because everybody's going to think you're gay. And I'm like, this is something I want to encourage because he loves this. And I stepped back and would laugh because you were the one scout, although he thought that you had all these things that you needed to change because they were effeminate. You were the scout that he was really into, like, jumping off bridges into water.
Well, not bridges, cliff jumping.
Cliff jumping and doing all these, like, manly things. And you were the only one that would do them. All the other scouts were, like, so way chicken. So he didn't know what to do with that dichotomy. And I just thought it was hilarious to watch it.
Because cliff jumping was fun. Like, I was willing to try it. Like, and all the other boys were like,
and then, like, we would... I went with you one time and we were loading wood. And... all of them were wimps about carrying wood and doing different things, and AJ was like, let's go and get it done. And he'd done it with me before, and, you know, I... Anyway, so I thought that dichotomy that the scout leaders didn't know what to do with was hilarious to watch.
And I felt ostracized a lot by the scouts, because I didn't feel like I was one of them, but I always was going.
Yeah, that was rough. But then also I really got angry at that scout leader, his problem with you having things that he called effeminate that I didn't even think of as a feminism.
Because I was really into fantasy, and I was in love with the Chronicles of Narnia books. Like, wholly in love with them. That was my world. Which is very Christian, but, you know. And I was obsessed with different magical creatures, and, like, I remember the huge issue where it came up where you went and talked to him was when we were going to go to the scouting event, and we had to come up with a mascot for our group. And I wanted to be the Pegatars, because... I wanted to be the Pegatars.
And tell us what a Pegatar is. I did not know what a
Pegatar is. A centaur, essentially, that has wings. So,
oh, I love those. Sorry.
You know.
A very manly
it's a very
creature.
It's a very, like, strong image, I thought.
But he was saying... even used the word bag about it, and he goes, what are all the other groups going to think when we show up with a unicorn? And I go, first of all, you weren't listening because he wasn't talking about unicorns. But secondly, you actually said fag. I was pissed.
Well, he literally, what I remember him saying to me was like, because the other boys were like, not really into it, and they were talking about other stuff. And I was like, really adamant I wanted to do this. And he said, literally said, we're not going to vote for the gays, or something
like that. Yeah, something like that. Like, maybe they didn't say fags, he said gays.
And I left the room. I remember I left the scout room and was outside.
I was so angry. And I talked to the bishop about it, too.
Oh.
Yeah, it was huge.
Oh, that's a major issue. Before you stop going to church.
We have to tell them the story. Because that's the pivotal part about leaving the church. Is even though, you know, you study all the things, and you see that, like, the papyrus was totally... The Pearl of Great Price is a total fake...
Which, I mean, I've known since BYU, but...
You've known it earlier. I didn't know it till the end.
Yeah.
You know, till Corvallis. When I found that out, it totally broke everything for me. You know, I mean, it was like the weak link in the chain.
Oh,
like,
yeah?
Once I found that out, everything else shattered. Because everything else was tenuous.
Hmm.
You know, Joseph Smith, tenuous. Everything was tenuous. And I read all about that. I read the journal Discourses.
Yeah.
So... I was not really the biggest fan of Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Already, because I read about him.
Then when you see the things that...
Then when I see that it's a total fake, because I finally start reading things that are not church-approved, you know?
You can even read that in church-approved stuff, but
yeah. Yeah, and then everything just broke apart. And so internally, everything was done. Everything was done internally with the doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when we had the, for the first time in my life, because seeing another woman, and then going and reporting to the bishop, and then...
Like, confessing right away.
You know, and that whole thing...
And he talks to me, too. And I'm just like,
yeah.
This is a non-issue.
And so it just became... Everything just kind of shattered at that point for me. And nothing could hold me into the church any longer. Nothing... And it turns out that after that, you know, when I finally came out, and I'm 40 years old, and I leave the church completely, I end up leaving almost every single relationship behind.
Yeah.
And people were so angry. Some people were surprisingly happy, I mean, but none of those people were in the church.
Yeah.
And I left much slower. I just kind of stopped going every week and then basically. But yeah. I think the last step with me, what all fell apart, yeah, because there was all this information that you can do. But in November of the November conference of 2011, when Packer basically said that being gay wasn't real. When he had that talk, it really angered me because it felt like it took the church back 20 years. Because I had read over and over everything on the church website that the general authorities had said about homosexuality. And I probably knew it better than the people said. I mean, I'd read these things 11, 12 times and looked at this progression that they were making, and I was holding on to this hope that someday the church is going to accept it. And then he goes back, and I was really angry. And then I thought, because everybody always would ask me in the church, what if what if God is telling the general authorities to say this? And I finally asked myself that question, and I said, so if God really did tell Packer and all these people to say this crap, I'll be happy to go to hell because he's a jerk. And then it was gone.
I think it's kind of interesting because just this month, I think so, month of May, or a little bit less, or maybe it was the end of April, but I found a PSA, or one of those It Gets Better videos.
Oh, yeah.
Produced by the Gay Straight Alliance at Brigham Young University.
Wow.
That brought me to tears.
Yeah.
And because I don't know what's changing, but at least the culture seems to change. I wonder if things will happen because there's a cultural shift.
Well, I think there is a huge cultural shift from the bottom up. But for the church to really change, I don't know. But just reading what the GA say and how they say it differently, I think at least six guys are going to have to die before the day.
But well, that won't take long.
That's true.
I think
a decade or two,
from
things will be different.
Me, when I started falling apart, was after President Hinckley died. I started to deteriorate even more, really, because, I don't know, I think I really enjoyed hearing Hinckley speak, but Monza was so boring. Like, when, and...
Hey, the same thing happened between Kimball and Benson for me.
Yeah. But, and Hinckley was like Kimball again, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hinckley, I really enjoyed him, and he always ended the meetings early, so I enjoyed when he would speak at the end of General Conference, because then it would be end early.
Think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was. Not sure yet of who I will become. Oh, but I'm feeling brave. I got nothing to lose. I'm so beautiful as I make no excuse. Now
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.